This is In Conversation from Apple News. Today, how a financial columnist got scammed out of $50,000 and ways to prevent that from happening to you. Hi there, I'm Julia Carpenter. For the next month, I'm going to be sitting in for Shamita while she's out on maternity leave. For a lot of my career, I've covered stories about money and personal finance. Most recently, I worked at the Wall Street Journal, and a few months ago, my first book, The New Rules of Money, hit bookshelves. So that's what I'm going to be diving into for the next few weeks on this show. All things personal finance and the different ways money impacts our lives. And for the first episode, we're talking about scams. Last year, on Halloween, around 12:30 p.m., Charlotte Coles got a call.
My caller ID said Amazon.
Charlotte answered it. And at least at first, it seemed like a standard customer service call.
The woman who claimed to be from Amazon customer service was very professional. She was saying, like, this call is being recorded for quality assurances. How are you doing today? We have this information about your account that we flagged and wanted to confirm this activity. It seemed like unusual activity.
The woman asked Charlotte if she had recently spent $8,000 on various electronics like MacBooks and iPads. Charlotte said she hadn't, and when Charlotte checked her account, there was no sign of these purchases.
And she said, oh, it was under your business account, and I don't have a business account on Amazon. And she said, oh, we actually, our records show that you have two. So it appears that your identity has been compromised.
Charlotte had seen recent headlines that Amazon had been having issues with identity theft, so this seemed plausible. Then, the supposed Amazon representative asked Charlotte if they could connect her with a liaison at the Federal Trade Commission, the FTC, who was investigating instances of identity theft on the site. Just 5 hours later, Charlotte Coles, an Ivy League-educated financial columnist, put $50,000 in a shoebox and handed it to a complete stranger.
Whenever I tell this story out loud, I feel crazy. Like, I know it sounds crazy. And if I had had to tell the story out loud to someone else when it was happening, I think I would have seen how crazy it was. But because I was in that real state of fear and stress, I could see it, but I still was too scared to act on it.
Charlotte recently wrote about her story for The Cut. And before we tell you more about what happened that day and how she fell for this scam, Charlotte wants you to know that no matter how smart or clever you think you are, something like this could happen to any of us.
I think everyone probably thinks of themselves as pretty reasonable and rational, but I particularly felt or have always identified as someone who keeps a pretty cool head, sometimes to an extreme. My stress response is to just remain extremely calm. I'm not someone who really loses it under pressure. And so for this to happen to me, just really such an extreme case of like lapse of judgment, you know, it made me question everything about myself. And that's an extremely common experience for anybody who is scammed. I've since learned that there are stereotypes that we have about people who get scammed. We think
right.
that they're maybe senile or at the very least elderly and not really informed about like how the internet works or, you know,
lonely,
gullible, prone to conspiracy theories. And that's just statistically, it's not true. Especially age-wise, people who are under 60 are actually 34% more likely to lose money to scams than people over 60.
Wow.
Yeah.
That really kind of blows my mind.
Yeah. The perceptions that we have are not factually true.
So this happened back in October.
Mm-hmm.
You had been on the phone with this person you thought was from Amazon.
Mm-hmm.
You were being connected to this person you thought was from the Federal Trade Commission.
Mm-hmm.
What was sort of your mental state at that moment? Were you looking to just try and like get off the phone? Were you?
Yeah. I mean, yeah. I was busy. I had meetings and calls and deadlines and other stuff to do. I really thought this was going to be just sort of like a quick like report that this thing happened and then be done with it. But what really got my attention and suddenly made me very nervous was that this man who said he was from the FTC, he said his name was Calvin, gave me his badge number, gave me his phone callback number. It was a DC area code. He had my social security number. He had my address. He had the names of my family members. He knew where I lived with my husband and son. And he knew a lot of personal information about me that suddenly made me very nervous. So that really got my attention and, you know, made me scared. I was suddenly very interested in what he had to say.
Calvin told Charlotte he was glad that they had gotten in touch.
He told me that my identity had been connected to a much larger investigation that involved my identity being used to wire millions of dollars overseas.
He also told her that 22 bank accounts, 9 vehicles, and 4 properties were registered to her name, and that there were warrants out for her arrest in multiple states.
They also said that my home was being watched and I was likely under surveillance.
He strongly urged her not to tell anyone what was going on, not even her husband.
They told me not to use my computer and to be very careful about my phone activity because it may have been hacked, which, again, struck me as very far-fetched and crazy, but was not something that I really wanted to take a risk and call their bluff. It was terrifying.
After being on the phone with Calvin for almost 2 hours, Charlotte was transferred to someone who said he was a CIA investigator. He introduced himself as Michael, and he gave her his badge number. At one point, Charlotte said she wanted to consult a lawyer, but Michael was quick to respond that if she talked to an attorney, he couldn't help her anymore. Her home would be raided. She might be arrested, but it was up to her.
I really was never fully on board, like, oh, this man really works for the government and I'd better do what he says. It was more that I really was too afraid to call his bluff.
So she stayed on the phone.
They told me that because my identity had been linked to this criminal investigation, they were going to need to freeze all of my assets and also deactivate my social security number because it had been so compromised.
At this point, Michael explained that she would need to use only cash until the investigation was over, which could drag on for months. He asked her how much cash she would need to support herself for up to a whole year. She guessed probably around $50,000.
I keep an emergency fund in my savings account, and there at the time was about $50,000 in it. I'm a freelancer in journalism, and so I have saved that up incrementally over many years.
Michael told her to go to the bank and withdraw that money and not to tell them what it's for. He said that in one of his last cases, the identity thief was someone who actually worked at the bank.
So I went to the bank and, I mean, I've never taken that amount of money out of the bank or anywhere close to it. I didn't even think they would give it to me.
Did they blink?
I mean, she definitely kind of looked surprised, but she didn't stop me. She gave me a sheet of paper warning me against scams, which I did look at. But at that point, I had not been told that I was going to be giving this money to anyone.
Right. It could just be sitting in your apartment.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which, you know, again, not ideal. Pretty crazy.
This entire time, even while she was at the bank, Charlotte was still on the phone with Michael. He was on speakerphone in her pocket. When she got home with the $50,000 in cash, he gave her the next set of instructions.
He had me put it in a box and label it with all of the information that they had about me. So my name, my social security number, my address. And he also gave me his name, a locker number, his badge number, and a case number.
Michael told Charlotte that they would close down her social security number later that night, and she'd lose access to her bank accounts. They'd make her an appointment the next morning where she'd get a new social security number and they'd issue her a treasury check for her $50,000. Then he told her that one of his associates was going to be coming to her apartment to collect the cash.
That was terrifying to me. I knew that my son was going to be home. I had $50,000 in cash there. I mean, it seemed wildly dangerous and unsafe. And I told him that I was not comfortable with this at all. And he basically said that I had no choice but to cooperate. And this was part of the protocol of the investigation, and that I had to meet with the person who was coming to my apartment. So I told him that I would only meet him outside.
It was just after 6 p.m.
And I went outside when the person pulled up in their car.
The back window of the car opened, and she put the money in the back seat.
At that point, I was just so terrified. I'd been on the phone with these people for almost 6 hours, and I was panicking.
Michael texted a photo of a treasury check made out to her for $50,000, and he told her it would be delivered to her tomorrow. But their call wasn't over yet. Michael kept her on the line while he said he was getting her an appointment at the Social Security office.
And a couple of hours went by. Like, we weren't actively talking, but we stayed in contact. And I took my son trick-or-treating. And
wow. With the phone on, right?
With the phone on.
Yeah.
Which was, like, really, really awful. I was afraid to talk to anybody. I didn't want him to hear my conversations with other people. Mm. It was just so invasive. And so we got back to our apartment, and they had hung up. And I called back, and one of his associates picked up, and she said, he's going to call you in the morning.
Mm.
And that was the first time that they had ever been inconsistent in what they had told me. And suddenly, it just all peeled away. It took a few hours for me to even realize that my identity had not been stolen at all. I was sort of like in this weird liminal state for a while when I was like, so wait, are we being watched or are we not being watched? I just had this moment where I realized this was not real. And I immediately told my husband what had happened.
What was that like?
I mean, I was so distraught. I think his immediate concern, and really throughout this process, was more just for me than anything else. And he encouraged me to call the police. So I did, and they came over to the house that night. I mean, I just felt incredibly stupid. I just, you know, I still do. So I know it sounds far-fetched. In retrospect, it sounds crazy. I still can't believe that I fell for it. And there are a lot of other people who think that they would never fall for it either. And maybe they wouldn't, but I think everyone thinks that they will act rationally in all situations. And when they're under extreme stress and they're trying to protect their family, you can't really prepare for that kind of situation or know what you'll do.
Since this happened, Charlotte's tried to piece together what happened to her, who was behind this, and who else this could have been happening to. She learned that what she experienced was something called a threat-based scam.
So a threat-based scam is you owe taxes and you need to pay it immediately or else you'll be arrested or your home will be seized or your assets will be frozen. I'm sure you've heard of like the AI scams where people will use AI to replicate the voice of a family member and demand ransom. Those are all examples of threat-based scams.
Another type of scam is known as an opportunity-based scam.
Those are like romance scams, investment scams.
You won the lottery.
Yeah, or like, here's this great opportunity to invest in crypto, and it's an exploding offer. You have to get back to me in 24 hours or else. And I know people who literally work in tech who have fallen for these crypto scams.
Oh, yeah.
So it's not just, again, it's not people who don't know better.
Yeah. I mean, you had these glimmers of realization along the way where you thought, this is a scam. I am being scammed. But keeping you on the phone, pushing you into these tasks, what else happened that made you stay on the phone and eventually hand over this cash?
He continued to mention my son, which I think any parent would, or, you know, any human would know is an extremely real pressure point. He really had an answer for everything. So every time I had a question, because something just seemed so wildly implausible to me, like no government agency would make you go get cash out of the bank and give it to someone. Like, I know that intuitively and factually. Like, I do know that. And when I said this, he said, well, you don't have to do anything that you don't want to do. But if I were you, I would not take that risk. Mm. He was very calm. He was very authoritative. And he really made me feel like I had no other choice. I've since learned that there's a term for this. It's called blocking the exits. It's sort of a textbook manipulation tactic where you really want someone to feel like they have nowhere to turn. So if you're trying to coerce someone into doing something, you want to cut them off from the people who would help them get a gut check.
Yeah, cut them off from reality.
Exactly. Yeah. That's really what they're doing. I interviewed a professor who studies manipulation, and his name is Saul Kassin, and he studies manipulation and coercion, particularly how it's used to coerce confessions, which is really interesting, but they're able to study that because they have recordings of those confessions, so they can see how people suddenly just sort of like lose their grip on reality and suddenly start doing things that aren't in their best interest.
And all their exits are blocked.
Exactly. Yeah. They're isolated. They're scared. They also feel like if they're innocent, things will just get worked out. Like, it's all a misunderstanding. And so if I just do what I'm told, then we'll all walk out of here and it'll be fine. And in my case, in many other people's cases, that does not happen.
The question that came to my mind was like, why were you targeted?
Yeah. So that's a really good question. And this was something that I was able to get clarity on that was really helpful. I spoke with experts at FINRA, the Financial Industry Regulatory Authority, who investigate scams. And they told me that in a lot of cases, every time there's a data breach anywhere, that data is scraped and sort of sorted out so that it's matched up with your name from other data breaches.
Whoa.
So it's kind of like scraped, sorted, bundled together. And these bundles become available for sale on the dark web.
Right.
So usually people get targeted when there's a bundle that seems big enough or, you know, seems like it might be able to hook you. So sometimes you get a call and it's a scammer who knows that you use that bank, right? Mm. So they'll say, hello, this is someone calling from such and such bank. And you're like, oh, I use that bank. So I guess I should pick up. But in other cases, there's someone who know your social security number and your dog's name and your kid's birthday and
your address.
Yeah. And your address and your previous addresses and your family members' names and where they live. Those were all pieces of information that they had about me.
You wrote that, I mean, so poignantly in your piece, you wrote, getting scammed is more than just losing money.
Yeah. Yeah. And that is the case across all different scam experiences. People feel so ashamed that it happened. Even scam victims believe that there is, you know, it doesn't necessarily increase empathy for other scam victims, which is crazy. There's a ton of self-blame. I certainly blamed myself. You know, I participated in this, and that is a really hard thing to forgive myself for. Scams are really underreported for that reason. Of course, no one can keep data on things that aren't reported. But there are different estimations. And on the lower end, they think that as few as 1 in 40 scams are reported.
On the lower end.
On the higher end, they think it's still less than half.
Wow.
So they know it's very underreported. How severely, you know, anybody's guess. But the research that they have been able to do on scam victims who have reported it indicates that most of them, over half, experience real struggles with mental health afterwards, serious cases of depression and anxiety, and it really, really takes a toll. So it's really serious. I mean, it's catastrophic financially, but it is really, it's really harmful psychologically as well.
I have to ask how you're doing with that 6 months after. Yeah.
I am okay.
Yeah. Do you think talking about it made a difference for you?
Yes and no. It was very helpful to report the piece and interview people who study this, it really helped me understand how it happened and that there is nothing uniquely wrong with me. I have gotten a ton of incredibly meaningful messages and emails from people who have read the story who have had something similar happen to them and have never felt like they could talk to anyone about it and really felt just so isolated and alone. And that has obviously been heartbreaking on many levels, but also just really reaffirmed why I wanted to write this and share this in the first place. More recently, I have started getting messages that are from people who tell me that they were in the process of getting scammed. And because they had read my story, they were able to do a gut check. And the data actually also supports that. There has been research done on people who were targeted by scammers and what was the difference maker between people who lost money and people who managed to disengage. And one of the biggest differentiators, it was not age, it wasn't socioeconomic status, it wasn't professional status, it wasn't education level. It was actually just if the person had heard of a similar scam before.
Wow.
And so something that simple of just talking about scams that you have heard of and sharing these stories, which are really vulnerable. I understand why people don't want to talk about them. But in sharing them, you are actually helping people and preventing future scams.
We have to talk about this part because I'm guessing what most listeners are thinking after hearing this is, okay, well, I don't want this to happen to me.
Yeah.
How do I make sure this doesn't happen to me?
I think that the most important thing you can do is really make sure that whenever someone is putting you in a stressful spot or makes you feel like you have to act quickly and you can't tell anyone what's going on, really stop and do a gut check and have someone who you trust, who you can reach out to in situations like that. And research shows that is one of the best ways to protect yourself. Another way is to just not pick up your phone, which is easier said than done, especially because scammers are so sophisticated in being able to spoof numbers.
Yeah.
I think that's more realistic for some people than it is for others. Another thing that you should do, again, you sort of have to piece these together because scams are always evolving. So just when you think that you've got sort of like a way to protect yourself from one, there's going to be a new type. But the most common form of scams is imposter scams. So that's someone who's saying that they're calling from like a government agency or an employer or someone of authority.
So what happened to you?
Yes.
Yeah.
So if that happens, what you do, you ask their name, you ask what agency they're with, you hang up and you call that agency directly.
Okay.
And ask to be connected with them. So you don't call the number that they give you. You don't stay on the phone with them. Come up with a reason to get off the phone. Say that you're losing service. Say that your battery's dead. If you are feeling under threat, you can lie. Just come up with a way to get off the phone and say you'll call them back and then call the number of the agency that they say that they're from.
What I appreciate about this recommendation you have of calling someone you trust is that it also then gets around that shame and embarrassment we've still been talking about in actually vocalizing and saying out loud, someone's calling me, they say they're from the FTC, they say they're from Amazon, and then allowing that other person to respond. It gives that opening for someone to say, no.
Yeah. I mean, whenever I tell this story out loud, I feel crazy. Like, I know it sounds crazy. And if I had had to tell the story out loud to someone else when it was happening, I think I would have seen how crazy it was. Mm. But because I was in that real state of fear and stress, I could see it, but I still was too scared to act on it.
What's a way to support someone who has gone through this without patronizing them or re-traumatizing them or, you know, making them repeat the story again and again at parties?
That's such a thoughtful question. I obviously cannot speak for everyone or anyone else, but just for myself, I feel so lucky that I have a really good support system. Mm. And I think understanding that people may want to talk about it or they may not want to talk about it, and to just recognize that as well and to try to be supportive in other ways. I've gotten a lot of email from people who have told me that they've never told anyone what happened to them. I feel for these people, and I hope that they can get the support that they need, but ultimately also that they can move on from it themselves.
Well, we're grateful you made the time to talk with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
If you're listening in the Apple News app, Charlotte's story for The Cut is queued up to play next. If you're listening in the podcast app, search for Apple News Plus Narrated to find her story.